All set? Okay, well, in our continuing series of ethics training for the IRB, I was a little surprised last time when I took a survey of what topics would be of interest using samples from old research, topped the list. So today let's look at the question of, may I use that frozen sample for a new study? And in looking at what's being balanced here, we're talking about patient rights. But whenever we talk about rights, I like to try to flip it over and say, what's our obligation? Yes, the patient, the subject has rights, but what's our obligation as a physician or as a researcher to that patient or subject? So the investigator has the following obligations. Research results from individual identified subjects must not be given to anybody else other than the subject without the subject's written consent. Seems kind of intuitive, but it's also fairly narrow. So we need to take that in consideration. And the more identifiable the subject is, the greater is our obligation to get consent. And part of your jobs as IRB members is to minimize the risks to the subjects. So when a protocol gets submitted for your review that wants to use samples from the freezer, there's a series of questions that you need to be able to get the answers from, for whether that's from the protocol itself, or you may even have to inquire of the investigator. Where did the sample come from? So it's been in the freezer for 6 months or 6 years, but where did it come from? What's known about the subjects from whom the sample came? Is this a study of were they left over from a study of newborns or from people with ALS or what? Can anybody know the specific origin of a specific sample? Can anybody? Not does anybody, because sometimes the question is, no, nobody knows, but maybe you can figure it out if you really work at it. For example, maybe we don't have the patient's name or a medical record number, but maybe we know what day the patient had surgery. Now that narrows it down from hundreds, thousands, to a dozen or two. And maybe if you pair that with the disease process and the date of surgery, you might be able to identify who it was. And what did the original subjects give consent for? And what might be the consequences of the new research? Well, there's not a lot written about this. I did a little investigation, but most of my information comes from the regulations. Now, regulations are a decent starting place, not necessarily the end-all be-all for answering ethics questions, but they're at least a place to begin. And the federal regulations say that research with already existing anonymous samples can be used in many circumstances if all of the identifiers are irretrievably removed. So that includes all of the HIPAA identifiers and anything else that might be pertinent. Then the specific wording from the common rule is, research involving the collection or study of existing data, documents, records, pathological specimens, or diagnostic specimens, if these sources are publicly available, or if the information is recorded by the investigator in such a manner that subjects cannot be identified directly or through identifiers linked to the subjects. So that's the boundary that's been set by the federal government. Now, what about the use of samples that could possibly be linked with individuals? Can you do that without consent? Well, you have the authority to give a waiver if there's no more than minimal risk. There's that phrase. And I expect you're going to expect me to tell you what minimal risk is. Sorry. We're going to talk about it some more next time when we talk about consent for research in children. But I don't have any gold standard for that. You're going to have to continue to wrestle with it. So that's one criterion. Or, and, if the waiver will not adversely affect the subject's rights, so you have to look at the whole ball of wax, not just at the research itself, And this one's pretty narrow. If the research could not be carried out without the waiver. Now, maybe somebody is requesting use of of samples that have some possibility of identification because it's convenient. You've got 200 samples of blood or urine from patients with ALS, and now you have a new idea. Well, instead of going out and tracking down 200 ALS patients, let's do these. And so the question before you is, in order to give that waiver, the research could not be carried out without. And when appropriate, the subjects, because you can identify them, will be given pertinent information. So this sort of sets the scene, but there are more questions that you need to consider as you look at this. The question of anonymizing identifiable samples. That's a new word form that I had not seen before, but it's pretty obvious what it means. So you have 200 samples in the freezer, and they've got patient names or subject numbers on them. You say, okay, we'll take them out and we'll tear off the tape and we'll number them 1 through 200. Is that okay? Well, it's permitted by the federal regulations, but not everybody agrees that this is appropriate. And I can't give you clear guidance one way or the other because you're going to have to look at the specific protocol, the specific requirements, what the risks are, and all those other questions. Another proposal is one that I'm not comfortable with, and that's setting up what's called a one-way link between the sample and the patient record. So one person has some matrix that they can use. So in case we ever need to know who that patient was, we can look into that record. So you have to have a trustee. And sure, you can probably choose a trustee that would be reliable, but it doesn't really close the gap sufficiently. So I'm not comfortable with that. What about the use of identifiable samples when the subjects are dead? Say you collect these 200 samples from ALS patients, and then 10 years later, they're still in the freezer, and you want to do another study. Most likely, all those subjects are now gone from their disease process. Is it okay to use those? Well, again, you're going to have to look at what are the risks. What are the risks if there were some survivors, or if it became known where the samples came from? Or what about if the investigator is dead, and you have the samples, and a co-investigator says, oh, they're still in the freezer, we could use those. And then a question which seems redundant, but it really, I think, is a little bit different. What about the use of identifiable samples for public health investigation instead of research? Instead of doing a study to understand the basic mechanisms of disease or to check on the feasibility of a new treatment or something, you're doing really demographic information just to see what's the prevalence of ALS or whatever in the community. Really different questions, but you need to be aware of what the question is being proposed and what are the risks and so on. And you may be a little more relaxed about allowing a waiver for that type of situation. So when samples are taken in research, the subject should be, and I don't remember that this was ever very commonly addressed in consent documents, but the subject should be informed whether the samples will be destroyed or saved. So a subject is going to give a series of 6 blood samples over a period of 6 months or whatever. Are they told these are going to be used and then we're going to throw away the rest? Or we're going to keep them in the freezer in case we want to do something later on. And they should also be informed whether the stored samples will be identifiable or not, because it makes a difference. If you're going to keep the samples without identifiers, there's a much lower risk to the patient's rights and so on. And if you're contemplating doing research down the road on identifiable samples, the subjects have to be informed about the types of information that might be obtained from the stored samples, informed about the potential for psychological distress, family disruption, social stigmatization, even discrimination, or what happens if the power goes off and you lose all the samples. And they should be asked. If you're going to store their identifiable samples, you should ask them if it's okay with them if those samples are used in future studies. And you really shouldn't just have a blanket rubber stamp endorsement in there. Yes, we can use them for any studies. There really needs to be some definition, some limits. For example, excluding commercial use or maybe some other limiting factors. And the subject should also be informed whether the subjects will be recontacted for consent. So we're going to keep your serum in the freezer. We might someday want to do further research. Are we going to contact you and ask your permission? Or are we just going to go ahead and use them? Are you giving consent now for us to do that? Or do you want us to call you? and I put this last thing in, not because it really fits here, but just because it's something that I was surprised when I learned this several years ago. Probably most people know this, but generally in genetic studies or in genetic clinical work, if it's discovered that there's non-paternity in a particular individual, it's generally decided up front that that will not be disclosed. And that's in the written consent form. And that sort of information is sort of applies here, not really, but it's the sort of thing that you need to think ahead about. Now, I came across a couple of empiric studies, one from the U.S., that asked 1,200 subjects if they wanted to know what they wanted to know about samples that they were giving for research. And 72% of them wanted to know about future research, even if the samples were anonymous, and 81% wanted to know if they were identifiable. So there's a significant number of people out there. Now, that doesn't necessarily set the standard, but people really want to know what's going to happen to their blood, urine, tissue, and so on. And 57% wanted consent to be required, whereas 43% said, no, it'd be all right as long as they were just notified. Then there was an interesting parallel study, not parallel, but a comparable study from Sweden, 2,100 subjects, and the same 72% wanted general consent at the outset. So they wanted to know up front if you plan to save their samples and possibly use them in the future. But that study asked them if the IRB could grant consent, and a large percentage, that same 72% said, yes, as long as we give consent beforehand and the IRB grants permission for the specific study. Now, in relation to these questions, four interesting cases, historical cases, that might shed a little light on what this is we're talking about. One of them is the Moore cell line, which was a big deal back in 1990. Mr. Moore had a routine splenectomy for a clinical condition. I don't remember if it was ITP or what it was, but his spleen was removed. And Dr. Gold, who retrieved the spleen, or took the spleen, took a little piece of it and developed a cell line, which was immortal, could be continued from one generation to the next, and he set up a commercial use for it. Well, when Mr. Moore found out about this, he was not entirely happy, and he said, hey, that was my spleen, I should be involved, I should be getting some of the royalties from this. So he sued, and it went all the way up to to the California Supreme Court, and the court says, no, not yours, not your benefit. But it really raised the issue. I remember that's the first time I ever even thought about samples. Second one is kind of a sad story. Dr. Catalano is a urologist who was practicing and doing research at Washington University in St. Louis. And he was the one who developed the PSA test. And he had kept 3,500 samples. And he had gotten consent from the subjects to continue to use the samples for specific research in relation to prostate cancer. And then at some point in time, I'm not sure when, early in this decade, he moved to another institution. And he did what seems to me the right thing. He asked the subjects if the samples they had given years before and were still in his freezer, if they could be transferred to his new institution so he could continue to do research. And Washington University said, no, they're ours. They're not yours. And that went to court, and the court sided with the university. So in spite of the fact that he was a qualified researcher, had done a lot, and had taken the effort to get the subject's consent, He lost this capacity that he otherwise might have had. A recent one from Texas. You know that neonates have their heels pricked to do screening for genetic testing and so on. And in Texas, they screen for 28 conditions. And between 2002 and 2009, over 5 million samples were collected, and they saved them. And they wanted to do more research without parental consent. And so this was taken up by a civil rights group. They sued, and the settlement was that all the samples had to be destroyed because no consent had been sought for further use. And a very recent one, closer to home, the Havasupai, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but I think it's Havasupai Nation, which is a Native American nation who lived down in the Grand Canyon. tribal members had given DNA samples because there was a very high incidence of diabetes in their cohort. And they had been informed of what the research was, and they consented and so on. But the samples were kept, and they were subsequently used for many other studies by the Arizona State University. And I don't know how they found out about it, but they did, and 41 tribal members sued, and the university paid a lump sum of $700,000 plus returning the samples to them and giving them other assistance. So this question, this issue, is not looked upon lightly, and it's tempting to see a protocol that really has scientific merit, that really might bring benefit to lots of people, say, well, let's just use these samples. Well, maybe we can and maybe we can't, but there are some specific guidelines. And after I had sent this in, I came across another. I was reading the Swiss Medical Weekly. You impressed? I said that to impress you. I don't really read the Swiss Medical Weekly, but there's a bioethics librarian in New Jersey who collates abstracts from ethics journals and once a month sends out 100 abstracts. It's just a wonderful service. But let me read you just part of this abstract because it just came across my desk. The title of the article is "What are the ethical and legal retrospective research? What are the ethical and legal requirements?" Retrospective research is conducted on already available data and/or biologic material. Whether such research requires that patient specifically consent to the use of their data continues to stir controversy. From a legal and ethical point of view, it depends on several factors. The main criteria to be considered are whether the data is anonymous, whether the researcher is the one who collected them, and whether the patient subject was told of the possible research use. Then skipping down what they found, because this really applies only in their particular legal environment. The present article provides an overview of the issues for physicians, scientists, ethics committee members, and policymakers involved in retrospective research in Switzerland. It aims at provoking more open discussion of the regulatory problems and possible future legal and ethical solutions. So I have looked at the question primarily from a regulatory standpoint, trying to throw in a little bit about the ethics of it. And I just wondered, Mr. Hansen, do you have any thoughts from a legal perspective to expand on this?
Sounds great for law and ethics to one side, as they usually do.
They usually do. Not always, but usually do.
Sometimes with legal, it's certainly not ethical.
Right. Comments, questions? I put that in just as a sort of a character of a qualification that could be inserted. Now, it doesn't have to be. Now, if the subjects are willing to consent to commercial use, I mean, I wouldn't if I were going to be a research subject. And as long as that's explained to them, and if they give specific consent, there's no reason not to do that.
This isn't saying that it's okay whether or not they can put it in the consent.
Right.
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 It can still be
I'm pretty sure this was, boy, I looked at the study when it came out a couple of years ago, and I didn't review it in detail for this. I'm pretty sure that these were subjects who were being entered into a study, and they were asked what their preference would be for the future use of stored samples. Now, I may be wrong. This could have been just 1,100 people walking along the street, they asked. But I think these were actual research subjects.
Well, the baseline for retrospective uses to me is the HIPAA privacy notice that patients give them coming to the institution, where they say that they acknowledge that this is an academic center and de-identified.
Right. I think, I mean, yes, I understand this is a HIPAA regulation, and I expect that 9 out of 10 people who sign this general consent going to the hospital don't really stop and consider that particular feature. So I think that if you're looking at a protocol that involves use of stored samples, that you need to be upfront. And if they truly are anonymous, then you've got more liberty with granting permission. If they are identifiable, then it's really tighter. Right. Betty, did you have a question? Data.
Science, mm-hmm. Research where people have participated in studies and given their information, or they may have even been psychosocial intervention kinds of studies. Most recently, just this last week, I saw some calls for research projects where they are now going to send investigators to do secondary analysis of that data. I have no idea if the original consent that people signed said that their data would be used in that way.
I doubt that it is, and I think your point about stewardship is valid, but at the same time, trying to put myself in the shoes of a research subject, I would like to know about that beforehand, and I think that behooves you as you look at protocols to keep that in mind. I think the thing that jumped out at me as I went through this was telling subjects that their samples are going to be stored or not. Seems like a simple thing. Either you're going to do it or you're not. And they have a right to know that, and then what's going to be possibly done with those samples. They are. Yeah. And fortunately, I can cop out and say, I'm not an attorney, I don't know the law, but it would look like, I mean, the earliest case was 1990, and they sided with the hospital. And then the second one also was, I mean, chronologically, the first two, they sided with the institution. So I don't know if that means there's a trend or not. And as far as I know, It hasn't been tested in the federal court system. Well, again, I can't tell you much about the liability issue, but from an ethics perspective, it seems to me that if you're going to put in the consent form that the samples are going to be stored and could be used in future research, you need to have some parameters about, and I think just a vague open-ended thing is probably not any better than not even mentioning it. So especially if there's the possibility of commercialization of the samples, I think that subjects really need to know that up front, or if it's anything identifiable. So I can't really give you clear guidance on what should or should not be in the consent form, but I would just urge that it not be so vague and open-ended as to be meaningless, that it really should have some parameters, some content.
Good. See why they didn't tell them.
Well, wasn't the Texas one also? They were looking at genetic origins. I think the Texas.
Is that right? I don't know what research they were proposing, but when it was discovered, it was kiboshed.
I think so.
It could well be. And I suspect with the expansion of genetic research, this question is going to come up more and more, because there are going to be a lot of samples stored, and people are going to want to know the genetics. It might be well to do some education with investigators who are planning studies so that they can cross the T's and dot the I's in the first place.
Takes those off. But the public policy is those should